A note on terminology. Writing a book on Buddhism confronts you with a number of choices about terminology. For starters, there is the Sanskrit versus Pali question. In Western writing, Buddhist terms are usually rendered in one of these two ancient languages, though there are also ancient Buddhist texts in other Asian languages. Some authors of books about Buddhism pick one language or the other and stick with it. That's not the path I chose, and I thought I'd explain why. The first big Buddhist concept this book engages with at length, not self, is emphasized more in Theravada Buddhism than in the other main branch, Mahayana Buddhism. The Theravada canon is in Pali, so it felt natural to render not self as anatta, as opposed to the Sanskrit anatman. But the second big Buddhist concept the book tackles, emptiness, gets more emphasis in the Mahayana tradition, and for that reason, the term is usually rendered in Sanskrit, sunyata. And a few key terms that are prominent in both traditions have, as it happens, become well known in the West in their Sanskrit forms, in particular, nirvana and dharma, as opposed to the Pali, nibbana and dhamma. So here I went with Sanskrit. Having made the decision to use both Sanskrit and Pali, I then had to face borderline cases, where there wasn't a particularly strong argument for either. I won't bore you with my reasons for making every choice I made. In some cases, I more or less flipped a coin. On the sutra, Sanskrit versus sutta, Pali issue, I played it both ways, depending mainly on whether the text in question is more closely associated with the Mahayana or Theravada tradition. But this issue comes into play more in the notes and bibliography than in the text of the book itself, because in the text I've tended to use the word discourse in preference to sutra or sutta. One reason is that I think in some circles the word sutra has come to connote something more like a poem or a reflection than an argument. And by and large, the Buddhist texts I'm focusing on make arguments. They may not make arguments in the modern sense of the word, all terms defined, each step in the argument clearly delineated, but they are advancing propositions about psychology or philosophy and giving reasons for them. And these propositions are at the heart of this book. Finally, I use the word enlightenment a lot in the book, and actually, awakening would be a more literally accurate translation of the ancient term that is commonly rendered as enlightenment. This is the term that is the basis both for the Buddha, awakened one, and for the name of the tree, the Bodhi tree, under which the Buddha is said to have had his great awakening. Awakening certainly has its appeal as a translation, given the Buddhist idea that we ordinarily live in such delusion as to be in a kind of dream world, and given that I begin the book by embracing that idea. At the same time, notwithstanding this metaphorical aptness, Buddhist awakening involves more than just waking up. There has to be actual enlightenment in the sense of apprehending, often arduously, some elusive truths about the world. As it happens, the term enlightenment has another relevant dimension. It signifies the era when the West made a decisive turn toward rational analysis. This struck me as apt, given this book's argument that the Buddhist worldview, or at least the naturalistic part of it, makes great sense by the lights of the philosophy and science that emanated from that era. Why Buddhism is True: The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment was written by Robert Wright and read by Fred Sanders. Editing and post-production by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Why Buddhism is True: The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.